This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you heard our interview last week with Sandra Katz about how fermentation changes milk to yogurt and cabbage to sauerkraut, you may have felt cheated because we didn't talk about how the process of fermentation creates wine, beer, cheese, and salami, which is why we now present part two of that interview. Sandra Katz is the author of The Art of Fermentation and has taught hundreds of fermentation workshops around the country. His book explains how and why bacteria transform beverages in the fermentation process and why some of these foods have probiotic qualities that are good for the digestive tract. He also offers advice about how to make fermented foods. Katz grew up in New York and now lives in Tennessee, where he ferments many vegetables from his garden. Let's talk about wine, which is fermented fruit. Why are grapes such a natural for fermentation?
Well, grapes have a really great balance of sugars and acids and tannins, so that they are a particularly good nourishment for yeast. I mean, making wine from grapes is incredibly easy. It's easy to get the juice out of grapes. I mean, I Love Lucy, I think, sort of showed us all how to make wine. I mean, if you stomp on grapes, it releases the juices. When I was on a farm in Italy a couple of years ago at the grape harvest, well, we weren't stomping with our feet, but they had this very clever little set of rollers that crushed the grapes a little bit. And so we picked the grapes and crushed them into grape juice with the grapes and stems floating in it. Then we went to eat lunch, and by the time we came back from eating lunch, the crushed grape juice was bubbling vigorously. The fermentation had begun immediately. So grapes are really easy to ferment, but any fruit can be fermented. And like where I live in Tennessee, we have this great tradition called country wines. And so actually yesterday I was driving on the road and saw a plum tree dropping plums all over the road. And I stopped my car and I picked a big bag of plums. And then when I got home, we mixed up some sugar water and poured sugar water over the plums. We'll have plum wine shortly. So you really can make wine out of any kind of a fruit, or even you can make flower-flavored wines or vegetable-flavored wines or herb-flavored wines. The idea of, fermenting a sugary liquid into alcohol, can be applied with, all sorts of ingredients beyond the most famous ones like grapes.
So what is it that turns the juice into alcohol? Is it the yeast?
Yes. I mean, yeast consume sugar and transform it into alcohol and carbon dioxide.
Okay. And is there a certain kind of yeast that you use to make wine?
Well, all fruits are covered with yeast. Yeast is really everywhere. So
you're not adding yeast. It just has the yeast in it, for the grapes anyways.
Yes. All sweet foods have yeast. Yeast are just everywhere, and they find their way to all the sweet things. The skins of grapes and plums and blueberries and other really dark-colored fruits, you can actually see a little white film, and that white film includes lots of different types of microorganisms, including yeast. Usually when people talk about yeast in relation to the fermentation of fruit into wine, they're talking about Saccharomyces cerevisiae. That's the most famous yeast. If you go to buy a packet of yeast, that's what you're buying. And so that's the yeast that people have been cultivating for thousands of years. But all sweet fruits have yeast on them. All honey incorporates yeast. Yeast is very easy to find on any of the foods that you might be fermenting, and it's just a matter of kind of working with it to develop the yeast that's there. So what I'm doing with these plums sitting in sugar water is stirring it frequently, and this basically distributes yeast activity, and the stirring introduces oxygen, which can really stimulate the yeast growth and proliferation.
Once you've made wine, you have to bottle it and make sure there's no air in it, that the wine isn't exposed to the air, because if it's exposed to the air for a period of time, it's going to turn to vinegar.
Well, yeah. I mean, you really have a number of options. I mean, one way you can do it is enjoy it fresh. You know, ferment it for 2 weeks, and you already have, you know, more than half of the potential alcohol has been produced, and you can just have a party and enjoy your wine without ever bottling it or aging it. That would be a green or young wine, partially developed. And, you know, in a lot of the ancient indigenous traditions of making alcohol, people had no means for fermenting it to dryness. So people drank, you know, fresher, more lightly fermented beverages. But yes, you're correct. If you want to ferment it for dryness, you know, meaning to the point where all of the sugars are converted into alcohol, then once your bubbling peaks and begins to slow down, then you need to transfer it to a different type of a vessel where it won't be exposed to oxygen. So typically we move it into a vessel that's called a carboy, which is a narrow neck vessel. It looks like what's on a water cooler. And then you put this device in it that's called an airlock that enables carbon dioxide that's being produced to escape, but doesn't allow air with oxygen from outside the vessel, you know, in to allow for vinegar formation. Then once the bubbling stops, typically people will siphon it into a second vessel, which can restart stuck fermentation and get the last of the sugars to be fermented. And only then, after it stops again, would you bottle it and cork it for long-term storage. And, you know, as we all know, you know, storing wine can really allow the flavors to mature and become, you know, much more refined and wonderful.
Okay, if you're just joining us, my guest is Sander Katz. He's the author of the new book, The Art of Fermentation. Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sander Katz. He's the author of the new book, The Art of Fermentation. Fermentation is his thing. It's what he writes about. It's what he spends a lot of his time doing, is making fermented foods and teaching people how to do it. We've talked a little bit about making wine. Now, beer is made out of grain, not fruit. So what's the difference in how you would ferment grain to make an alcoholic beverage?
Grain-based alcoholic beverages, they're much more technically demanding than fruit-based or honey-based alcoholic beverages, because fruit and honey will really spontaneously ferment into alcohol, whereas grains, which are complex carbohydrates, long chains of carbohydrates rather than simple carbohydrates, need to be pre-digested. They need to have those complex carbohydrates broken down into simple carbohydrates. In the Western tradition of beer making, we do this through malting, which is germination or sprouting, and that sets in motion enzymatic changes that breaks down the starches into sugars. In the Asian tradition, molds are used, which accomplish this same kind of enzymatic breakdown. And really, the most ancient method of doing this is chewing, using our human saliva and the enzymes that are in our saliva to break down starches into sugars, and then you brew the beer from the grains that have already been malted or otherwise enzymatically broken down into starches. But beer is wonderful, and you know there's a thriving movement of home brewers all around the United States, of people making beers themselves. Just last night, I had some Nepalese style millet beer. That's a warm beer. You know, beers are made out of, you know, every kind of grain in every part of the world, you know, in my limited explorations, they're all delicious.
So you said that sometimes with beer you can chew the grain, like chew the barley to like mash it up. And like, has anybody really made beer that way, where there's a lot of people like chewing the grain and spitting it out? Like, that doesn't sound really appetizing.
Well, I mean, this is a traditional method in the Andes Mountains of South America for making a corn beer called chicha. There are also examples of you know, beers that have been made in other parts of the world using this process. It's generally regarded as the most ancient form of enzymatic transformation of starches and grains and tubers into sugars that are fermentable into alcohol. So I don't think that there are a lot of people doing it these days. I've done a number of, experiments, in my own practice and, gotten people to sit around and, chew corn or in my most recent experiment, chew potatoes with me, to produce an alcoholic beverage out of them. And it's fun, and some people get really, really freaked out at the suggestion of it.
I can see why.
Well, then you cook it. I mean, then you brew it after that.
Oh, you cook it after that?
Yeah, then you brew it after that. You cook it for a really long time. So, I understand how, conceptually that it's difficult for people, but, anything that would be alive in the saliva that chewed it gets destroyed during the cooking. So I don't think it's, any kind of a, danger.
I feel better already. Okay, very good.
And chicha is really delicious.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about cheese, which is also a fermented food. What's the difference between making cheese and making yogurt?
Well, with yogurt, you're typically not removing any liquid. You're just, it's kind of this magical process where you're transforming the liquid into a solid. With cheeses, typically you're removing some of the liquid. Most often this is done with a group of enzymes that we call rennet. And the rennet curdles the milk. The milk solids and fats all come together. And then there is a byproduct, which is this thin yellow liquid that's still really quite nutritious called whey. But part of what preserves cheese is the removal of liquid from the milk, so it becomes more solid. I mean, we could really think of, a chunk of cheddar or Parmesan cheese as, a form of preserved milk. I mean, think how stable that is, the cheese compared to the milk. And one reason for this is the removal of liquid. Another reason for this is the acidification. So just as with sauerkraut, the acidification makes it impossible for bacteria that we would regard as pathogenic or threatening to us to develop because they can't tolerate an acidic environment.
So how does fermentation apply to meat?
Well, I mean, meat is certainly the most perishable of all the foods that people eat, meat and fish. And so, it has really been, imperative for people to, figure out ways of preserving meat. And people use a range of techniques to preserve meat without refrigeration, including drying, salting, and smoking. And, sometimes it's been a little bit elusive, which cured and preserved meat products are products of fermentation. But in most of them, there's at least some incidental fermentation that enhances the flavor of the meat. But I think that the clearest example of a fermented meat process would be salami. So basically salami is ground meat that is mixed with salt and curing salts and spices and a little bit of sugar. And what the little bit of sugar does is it supports a lactic acid fermentation. The nutrient for lactic acid bacteria that meat lacks is carbohydrate. So by adding some carbohydrate, you promote lactic acid development. And so the lactic acid becomes part of what enables that salami to just hang on a string in a delicatessen for months and months.
So how did you become, as you describe it, a fermentation fetishist?
Well, the development of my interest in fermentation has a few stages. When I was in my 20s, I did quite a bit of dietary experimentation, and for a while I was following a macrobiotic diet, and that was when I first became aware that there was some association with eating these live fermented foods and digestion. And I started noticing that whenever I would eat sauerkraut or pickles, that the flavor of the lactic acid, even the smell of it, would make my salivary glands start secreting. And so I just started really feeling how these foods got my digestive juices flowing. But it wasn't until I moved from New York City to a community in rural Tennessee and got involved in keeping a garden that I ever actually tried fermenting anything myself. And what motivated me was, the practical desire to make use of the bounty of the garden. It came as a little bit of a surprise to me that all of the cabbages are ready at the same time and all of the radishes are ready at the same time. So this is really a practical dilemma that, gardeners and people who grow food have always faced. And, this is really has been the incentive for people to, develop fermentation methods. I mean, really, agriculture makes no sense without fermentation. And, that's what got me to look in the joy of cooking and learn how to make sauerkraut for the first time.
You're very public about this, so I feel comfortable asking, but I know you've had HIV for many years. And you're on one of the drug regimens, which has really helped you a lot. Does having HIV connect at all with the kind of emphasis on fermented foods that you've had?
Well, living with HIV has just forced me to think a lot about, what I can do in my life to, help keep myself healthy. Think of it as, rituals of self-care. These have to go beyond, popping pills. It's, thinking about good nutrition. It's thinking about, things that reduce stress observing how fermented foods improve my digestion and, learning about how, probiotic bacteria really stimulate immune function, generally feeling good day to day has really, confirmed the idea that these foods are part of a strategy for keeping healthy. I mean, I am very suspicious of, miracle cures, panaceas, promises of specific benefit from specific foods. But, as a group, these foods really can help people digest their food better, get more nutrients out of their food, and have, better overall immune functioning. And these are great benefits, regardless of whether they cure any particular disease.
So what did you have for breakfast today?
I had eggs and toast.
Okay, very, very, very plain.
Well, okay, but I mean, I would just point out that, and I had coffee. I mean, most people eat fermented foods every day. I mean, all fermented foods.
What's fermented in that list there?
All bread is fermented and coffee is fermented.
Oh, you see, I don't think of them as fermented foods. I'm not thinking correctly.
Well, it's like, you need to, in typical contemporary bread making, you add your yeast and the yeast activity is what rises the bread, the carbon dioxide that's produced by the fermentation. In traditional bread making, you use natural leavens, which are mixed communities of yeast and lactic acid bacteria that are really found on all grains. And so it's a slightly slower process, but actually improves the bread's nutritional profile, introduces more complex flavors, and makes the bread storable for a much longer period of time. But either way, the bread is definitely fermented because the microbial activity is, sort of key to the bread not being a dense brick.
And now you're going to tell me coffee is fermented?
And yeah, coffee as well as chocolate are fermented on the harvesting end, so we really never see it. But with coffee, it's just the freshly picked beans are moistened and held together, in some sort of a box or vessel, and they are fermented for a few days before they are dried and roasted.
All right. Well, Sandra Katz, thank you for telling me a lot that I didn't know about fermented food. Much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be on your show.
Sandra Katz is the author of The Art of Fermentation. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.